You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Here's a question for you. Are you registered to vote? Probably a question you're thinking about right now. If you're over the age of 18 and you're not serving prison time and you're a United States citizen living in the state of California, you probably are registered. This year, an historic 21 million people are registered in this state. That's 83% of eligible Californians. Of course, registering is only half the battle. Then you have to decide which propositions to support, how you're going to submit your ballot, and with the global pandemic, all of those questions have gotten, yes, a little bit more complicated. KCRW's Kaylee Wells has been keeping track of the 2020 election logistics, and she joins me right now to talk about it. Hey, Kaylee.
Hey, Steve.
Now, I am registered to vote. I know that because I can go online and see that. I've been getting some information in the mail as well about mail-in ballots, although I have not received one of those yet. What do I do to get a mail-in ballot?
Well, you actually don't have to do anything. That's the first time this year in California that that's true. Because of the pandemic, they've decided that they're going to send a mail-in ballot to everybody in California. October 5th is the first day that those start going out, but you and I, Steve, both live in Los Angeles County, which is giant, so those aren't all going to be going out on the same day, and it might take a week or two for you to actually get that in the mail, so you're going to have to hang tight.
So it could be way deep into October before people start getting those mail-in ballots, which only leaves them then a couple of weeks to turn things around, right?
Right. I wouldn't worry until maybe mid-October. If you aren't seeing it by then maybe you might want to double check your registration status. But if you're getting information already in the mail about, you know, the voter guide and any other kind of voting information, then you should be okay.
You're on the rolls, as it were, right?
Exactly.
Now, what if I moved, or what if I, say, changed my name?
So if you did move or if you changed your name, you might not be getting that information in the mail. It's probably time to double check before we get into that mid-October time. So the way you do that, and you're going to want to get out your pen and paper here, you go to voterstatus.sos.ca.gov, or honestly, just Google voter status California and it is ready for you. So I actually just did this. It takes about less than 30 seconds to just put in your information, see what they have for you. It told me my name, told me my address, it told me my political party. If any of that's wrong, or you find out that you're not registered at all, you can register right there online, or you can do that by phone or by mail. And if you choose to do it by phone, that number is 800-345-VOTE.
All right. That's a simple number, 800-345-VOTE, or voterstatus.sos.ca.gov, which we will have a link to at our website, by the way, and the phone number, too. So if you didn't get it this time around, we will have it for you at our website, kcrw.com. When is the deadline to get all of that done, Kaylee, to register to vote?
So the magic day is Monday, October 19th, which is just under 3 weeks from today. So if you're going to do that again, we're going to go through this again online. That's registertovote.ca.gov, or again, Google register to vote California. It's the first thing that pops up. Just did it. You can call, as I said, and then they send a registration form to your address, or you can pick up a registration form at any government office. So the DMV by your house, a post office, a lot of public libraries have them. If for some reason you can't get it done by Monday, October 19th, don't stress. You can still register up to November 3rd, which is the last day to vote, and your vote still counts. It's just what they call provisional, which means you're counted. It's just probably not going to get tallied until after the election is over. So to kind of explain that, I spoke with her name is Kim Alexander. She's the president and founder of a nonpartisan group, California Voter Foundation, and she kind of explained how that works.
You'll fill out a voter registration application, and then you'll fill out your ballot. Your ballot will go inside the envelope that has your registration information on it and your signature, and your county elections office will first verify that you didn't vote somewhere else. And once they've done that, then your conditional registration application will be approved and your ballot will be counted.
All right. We keep hearing, Kaylee, about the Postal Service being overwhelmed. Republicans are saying that mail-in voting could lead to fraud. Should I be worried about my vote getting counted?
Let me see if I can quell your concerns a little bit. So it turns out that of all the mail-in ballots that they receive, only about 2% of them get rejected. And there's three main reasons for that. Either your ballot was sent too late, in which case your vote's just not going to count. There's no chance to redeem that. Or your signature doesn't match the signature that they have on file for you. So maybe you signed your driver's license years ago and your handwriting has changed, or maybe sometimes there's someone else's signature on there. And generally the reason that happens is because that's not someone trying to steal your vote. It's chances are that somebody else in your household did the signature for you. They were trying to do you a favor. It turns out that actually doesn't work. So in that case, the counties are actually required by state law to contact you and give you a chance to verify your identity so you can make your vote count that way. When it comes to fraud and mail-in ballots, Kim Alexander says that's actually really rare.
The president has decided to make it a key talking point to make people worry about voting by mail when in fact there's really not an issue with it. I mean, we have been doing it in California on a widespread basis for decades.
Certainly a lot of politicization going on with that, Kaylee. Will the state of California, on the other hand, when we're talking about the Postal Service, will the Postal Service be able to handle the extra mail? And will the state be able to handle all that mail coming in?
I actually posed that question to her as well.
I think that California is in a better position than a lot of other states with this pandemic because we already have widespread use of vote-by-mail balloting. We had 72% of the ballots cast statewide in the March primary were cast as vote-by-mail ballots. So our voters are already, many of them are already well-experienced with using vote-by-mail ballots, and I think that's going to be to their advantage.
So California is used to having that high by-mail participation. Remember LA County Registrar Dean Logan, he told us earlier that California is preparing for delays in case that does happen.
We know that there is a trend where mail is taking longer to get back to us. So the legislature did extend the period of time. So as long as your vote-by-mail ballot is postmarked on or before Election Day, we can receive it up to 17 days after the election, as long as it was postmarked. So there's demonstration that it was in the mail by Election Day, then we will still be able to process and count that ballot.
So Kim Alexander's advice this year, and this is actually what I'm planning to do too, you can start filling out your mail-in ballot as soon as it shows up. Then you can take your time with it. And then you could drop it off at a drop box, which are, those are going to start popping up soon. They're like, they look like FedEx or UPS boxes on street corners. Or you could drop it off at any vote center. That's my plan. And that way you can take the time with your mail-in ballot. But if you're nervous about the Postal Service, you can drop it off, make sure that it's counted without going through the extra health risk of standing in line at a voting center.
Is there a way to make sure it's counted? Like, do you get a receipt or can you check a website that says, hey, your vote was counted?
You can. There is a website for that. And that one is called wheresmyballot.sos.ca.gov. Where's My Ballot? So that was actually available in the last election back in March. I used it. I loved it. It tracks your ballot kind of like a package. So it tells you when it was shipped, when it got to your house, when it arrives back once you send it in, and when it actually gets tabulated. And you can actually get alerts sent to you. You could get a text or an email, so you're not having to check back and make sure that it's in there. That's what I did, and it just showed up in my email, and it said, hey, your vote's been counted.
The question I think I get from a lot of people is, do I have to vote by mail? You mentioned the March primary election, and I remember just before the pandemic, standing in a long line to those voting centers. And if I want to vote in person, or just wake up on Election Day and decide to vote, what's that going to be like?
So if you live in Orange County or LA County, it's going to be the new voting center model. So you're not assigned to a local polling place by your house. You can go to any one of them in the county. Some of them open up October 24th. Most of them open up October 30th. And if it's anything like it was in March, those beginning days, there weren't lines at all. I was seeing a couple voters per hour coming through. So it's not necessarily, though, the same centers that you saw last time. Maybe last time you voted in a church hall or an elementary school classroom. This time they're actually going to try and make them in bigger places, so it's easier to socially distance. Some of the fun ones, Dodger Stadium. You could vote in Dodger Stadium. You could vote at the Forum. They haven't made available yet where all the voting centers are. You're going to get that location info in the mail, but there are going to be hundreds of them.
KCRW's Kaylee Wells keeping track of the voting process throughout the 2020 election here in Southern California. Kaylee, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Working from home. Maybe you're doing it. I am, still. Months after the coronavirus spread like wildfire through America, a pandemic that has wrought so much on lives across the globe. But you know what else it did? It forced creativity in the way business is run, where you do business and how you do it. You could be on a Zoom meeting thousands of miles away from corporate headquarters. You could, say, broadcast your radio show from the corner of your living room. You can get things done just as easily through the ether as you could in person. You're learning that, right? And to a lot of folks, it doesn't much matter anymore where you live. Well, what does that freedom mean to the housing market, to the job market? Who's leaving LA because they can live cheaper somewhere else while doing the same job? Who's coming to LA because, hey, they want to be here and they can work from LA now and maybe go surfing in the morning? Ben Bergman is a reporter with .LA. He's written a story about migration in the wake of this pandemic. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm all right. You talked to a number of Angelenos who are using the pandemic as an opportunity to get out of greater LA. What is their rationale? Is it too expensive, too many fires, climate change? What is it? What's going on?
It's really all of the above, but it's mostly that it's too expensive. I talked to a lot of people who, by a lot of standards, are making a lot of money. They're in tech. They're making well above the median income for LA. But in one person's case, she had recently moved to Venice Beach to an apartment where she was paying over $3,000 a month for a one-bedroom apartment. She could walk to the beach. She could walk to her tech company office on Abbot Kinney. But then the pandemic struck and she was stuck at home. She had to ride a shared elevator. She wasn't going to the office. So instead, she moved for what she thought would be a temporary stay with her family in Las Vegas. But she ended up liking it so much that she bought a house there. And now she's paying a mortgage of $2,000 a month. She has a pool, a hot tub, a half acre of land. She has enough room for her own dance room. Suddenly, you know, she doesn't need to be in California, so she's able to buy a big house in Las Vegas. And for the first time in a long time, she doesn't feel financially stretched. And that means much less stress for her.
You know, you and I both have lived here for quite a while now. And I know we've, as reporters, have been watching people leave LA because it's just become too expensive. There's been more traffic and housing prices way on the rise. Folks leaving in search of more affordable pastures, right? This isn't anything new, is it?
This is not new. This has been a trend for a couple years. There has been a net outflow of residents from California going to cheaper cities like Las Vegas, like Phoenix, like Sacramento, where they can buy a house, which they can't do here. But what COVID has done is accelerated these trends because people aren't tethered to their jobs anymore. So they've been thinking about it for a while and they say, well, if I can work from anywhere, why am I living in a tiny, expensive apartment in LA when I can buy a house in Las Vegas or Phoenix?
Are companies encouraging their workers to do things like that, to maybe live cheaper and maybe even take a pay cut to move to Vegas where the cost of living is lower?
I wouldn't say encouraging, but they're certainly allowing it. And, you know, it's interesting because these people for now are still making those LA wages. And in the case of Nevada, they don't have to pay state income tax. So it's a huge raise for them. So it'll be interesting to see whether those companies actually cut the salary to adjust for the other places, because in the case of some companies like Facebook, they've said, okay, you can work elsewhere, but if you're going to be working in Texas, we're paying you Texas wages, not California wages.
You've also talked with workers, Ben, going in the opposite direction, people who are coming to LA because it is expensive in other cities as well. Talk a little bit about that. People coming from, say, San Francisco or New York.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting, Steve, because I talk to a lot of people who are fleeing LA because of the housing prices we know all too well. And that's definitely the trend. More people are leaving. Over 10,000 people left in July alone. But there's also people from New York or San Francisco who LA represents a big bargain for them in terms of housing prices. And I think we would certainly argue also offers a better standard of living. So I talked to a CFO from New York, and he's always wanted to trade Manhattan for Manhattan Beach, but he couldn't because his wife works in advertising and she had to go into the office every day. But now that she doesn't, they finally were able to realize their dream they've had for 20 years and move to California. So people say, you know, if I can work from anywhere, I might as well have the beach and the sunshine of LA. And if I'm coming from those expensive cities, I'm probably paying less for rent.
It's certainly relative, for sure. But when you look at housing prices, Ben, I mean, they're certainly on the rise. Even now, even in the middle of the pandemic, housing prices are on the rise. There may be fewer houses being sold, but the median price is certainly still goes up and up. So most of the workers who are migrating are obviously in a higher socioeconomic bracket, right? I mean, these are folks who can afford things like this.
Yeah, and that's the problem, Steve, is there's less houses being sold, so there's so little inventory that what is on the market is very expensive. And I talked to a real estate agent who said when COVID first happened, she said, oh no, you know, my business is done. This is going to be horrible for real estate. But she's actually the busiest she's been in 16 years. She's seen bidding wars and all sorts of crazy stuff happen that hasn't happened for a long time. And she says a lot of it is from people calling her from New York. She used to get maybe one call a month from New York. Now it's every week and she's having to turn down clients. But you're right. This is only in a certain part of the market, and it's especially concentrated on the west side. For all these people I talk to, they're all kind of moving to the same places, Manhattan Beach, Venice, Santa Monica, Marina del Rey, much fewer moving to other parts of LA.
What kind of impact do you think all of this is going to have on LA as a whole? I mean, I wonder if these changes will just lead to this bigger wealth income gap in LA. The folks who can afford it can stay, or they move on to other places that are even more expensive. And the folks who can't move to affordable cities, well, they're stuck, right?
I think, unfortunately, it does make our city more bifurcated. And it increases the gulf between the haves and the have-nots that was already very substantial. I would also say that, you know, there has been this net outflow of residents from LA for quite some time, but that's been offset to a certain extent by immigration. And right now you're seeing barely any immigration. So that's having a big effect.
Ben Bergman, whose story is out on .LA a little later this week, on Thursday, I believe. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The idea of a gondola serving Dodger Stadium has been around for years. A cable system with pods to transport you from Central Train and Bus Point Union Station all the way up to Chavez Ravine. It would be about a 7-minute ride. But here's the question. Would flying over all that traffic entice you to forego driving the car to the baseball park? Well, the board of LA Metro recently took another look at that plan and is set to move forward with an environmental review starting this week. Alyssa Walker is urbanism editor over at Curb. She's a regular contributor, of course, to All Things Transit here at Greater LA. Hey, Alyssa.
Hello, Steve.
So is this proposal any closer to actually getting off the ground?
Getting off the ground. I get it.
See what I did there? Yeah.
Yeah. We still have to go through the process where we do, as you said, an environmental review and do the outreach. A lot of people live around the stadium. They would be directly impacted by the gondola being put in. So it's just making sure that everything is cool with those communities and then determining what the impact would be on the neighborhoods and the region in general.
The one question that I've always had about this is how practical it would be, right? Because when I think of a gondola, I think of, you know, as a skier going up a mountain. I think of San Jacinto and Palm Springs, you know, the giant gondolas that go up and down San Jacinto. Can those pods really handle the kind of volume of traffic that we're talking about thousands of people who need to get to a certain place at a certain time.
Yeah, so what you mentioned, two really important things. One is the Palm Springs gondola is actually an aerial tramway. That's a little bit different in the sense that it's just two pods. They're large, but they go back and forth. They kind of trade places going up the mountain. And this is, like you said, it's a gondola system, much more like you see when you go to a ski area. It would be multiple pods, and they would be able to hold probably between 30 and 40 people. And they would travel, just like you said, like in a ski area type configuration. They'd go up the hill, you know, every few seconds. But you're right in that they're not usually used for this type of application. For example, in the Bolivian city of La Paz, they have gondolas like this that are actually their transit system. You go there and you just see these beautifully brightly colored cars kind of traveling quietly above you in any part of the city. But they're not really designed to take large numbers of crowds and get them to one place at a certain time. I talked to some transportation engineers who were a little bit iffy about, you know, could it transport these guesses of about 10,000 to 12,000 people for a game, which would be a lot of people. You might be waiting in line for quite a long time to get up the hill.
Have they said how much it's going to cost to ride it?
They did say that it would be less than the cost of parking. And I don't know if you've parked there recently, but parking can be up to like 50. Yeah, so it could be up to $50.
But, well, if you do the preferred parking, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It would cost money, but they haven't really set a price yet.
The former owner of the Dodgers, an infamous name in L.A., Frank McCourt, who still owns the parking lot, by the way, around Dodger Stadium, is behind this plan, the gondola plan. And I suspect that alone might be enough to turn off many a Dodger fan. is his company paying for all of this? Or, I mean, L.A. Metro just made some big cuts in its budget, so I'm assuming it doesn't have the money to put into this kind of project?
Yes, this is all privately funded. It's an entity that was created by him. It is seen by some folks as a plan to get people up to the parking lot and then eventually develop that parking lot, right? Because you're right, he owns this, you know, 16,000 space parking lot around the stadium. And you could think that it might be better used for something like, you know, restaurants that are there maybe year round, or I don't know, maybe people could live there even. And this is like one step in being able to make it more connected with the rest of the city.
We would be remiss if we didn't say people did live there at one time.
That's true. Those people would be allowed to move back there first, or their relatives and ancestors.
It's quite the story. It sure is.
Yes.
Aren't there already buses that will take you from Union Station to the game?
Right. The Dodger Stadium Express, which I just call the Dodger Express, it works really, really well. I mean, they just use regular Metro buses. They load them up around the same part of Union Station. They can be flexible based on capacity. So, for example, a gondola is supposed to be able to take, you know, about 5,000 people per hour up the hill. If there's suddenly a lot of people that need to take the bus, they can add more buses. And then a dedicated bus lane, believe it or not, which part of Sunset is a bus lane just for these Dodger Express buses, can carry about 4,000 to 8,000 people per hour. That's a lot of people that can move, you know, if they're just keeping the buses pumping, going up and down the hill. So I think it's a pretty great solution. It's pretty low cost. It works really well. And from the surveys they've done, 80% of people who ride the Dodger Express are taking transit for their whole journey. So one of the promises of this gondola is that it's going to take 3,000 cars off the road per game, which doesn't actually sound like that much, actually. It doesn't, but for all the investments you're going to make just to get 3,000 cars off the road, you're like, yeah, well. But what the Dodger Express is actually doing is proving that people will take transit for their entire journey if you make it really easy to make that final connection.
Well, yeah, and I have friends in Echo Park and Silver Lake, and they're like, hey, come over and we'll walk to the stadium. And I'm thinking, all right, we could do that. But then you're trekking all the way up Chavez Ravine, which is it really is a ravine. So, and my body isn't what it used to be. I mean, how foot friendly of a trek is that?
And especially after a few Dodger dogs and a 20-ounce beer, I mean, your body really isn't the same. But I mean, I think walking to the game is actually a kind of a really great hidden secret if you're able to do it. I mean, it's not an option for people who have mobility devices or other things. You know, it's just not very easy to do unless you really feel like you said, you're going to get that exercise in as part of the game. But it's actually not that far away from some major transit connections. It's only like a 12-minute walk from the Sunset bus stops, which is serves plenty of buses serve there. It's only a 20-minute walk from the Chinatown Gold Line station. The problem is it's just not prioritized. You know, it's not saying that walkers are welcome here. They always say they're making new improvements, and then you go and they just like painted the shoulder blue, which doesn't make you feel safer. It doesn't make you feel like you'll be able to get there, you know, in one piece. And then it's not a very direct route, especially when you're coming from that Chinatown direction. There could be a very simple change that they could make to make it a little bit straighter. And then it wouldn't take so long to walk up the hill. But I do think you're right in suggesting that, you know, just to give people more options is better. Just like you said, that a lot of people live around there. They need better access to get to Elysian Park. We have this beautiful park that's actually very hard to get to and doesn't have great sidewalks, doesn't have great pedestrian infrastructure, even for the people who are using the park. So let's make those investments first and see if that cuts the car trips. And then we could talk more about, you know, letting Frank McCourt build his gondola.
Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor over at Curbed, and of course a regular here at Greater LA. Alyssa, always nice to have you on.
Thank you, Steve. Go Dodgers.
Oh, yeah. National League West. Nice. Dodgers. Go Dodgers. That's it for us today. And the Lakers, too, by the way. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, the pros and cons of Prop 16 on the November ballot, which, if passed, would once again allow California to look at race and sex and other factors when making decisions about things such as college admissions, jobs, and state contracts. A deep dive tomorrow. Check out our program online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us how you're doing. Grab the podcast, too. Join your friends and neighbors who are checking out this show on their schedule. You can do that, too. Subscribe at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Paul Smith, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Todd, Jody Adler, and Christian Bordahl all made this show happen today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Glad you came along, too. Thanks for your ears and attention. Have yourself a great Tuesday.